Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. It is March 8th, and we have a number of bills up today for public hearing, and we also have a possible work session. First, we are going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 83, and Beth, if you can provide us some overview, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 83 requires the Department of Environmental Quality to establish a program to provide loans and grants to owners of subsurface sewage disposal systems for repairs, replacement, and decommissioning of those systems, and development of a community-based solutions for sewage disposal problems. There is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. No revenue impact, and we have not received a fiscal impact statement yet.
Okay, great. Thank you. And Dick Peterson, and Entourage, tell us why this bill is before us. Yeah, that's the fancy French term
people. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, Director of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality. With me today is Randy Trox, who's our on-site program coordinator. Randy's not going to provide testimony. He's just here to help answer questions if you have detailed questions about the program. I'm pleased to be here to speak to you about Senate Bill 83, in support of Senate Bill 83, because what it does is it authorizes EQC to adopt rules for DEQ to make grants or loans to homeowners who need financial assistance for repairing and replacing failing septic systems. This bill is an outgrowth of our work with an on-site advisory committee that we worked with and met in the 2009 time period. They made recommendations for prioritizing current resources and identifying the future direction of the program. And as I said, this bill is an outgrowth of that particular work. So why is this important? There's about approximately 30% of Oregonians rely on septic systems for disposal of wastewater. There's an estimate, national estimate, that nationwide somewhere between 5 and 25% of all septic systems are failing, and I think that's probably a fair reflection of what's going on in Oregon, although we don't have specific data on failing systems, but we certainly deal with them a fair amount. Failing septic systems contribute to surface and groundwater pollution, and they can also, through their failure, they can create public health hazards. So what Senate Bill 83 does, it establishes a fund that's named in the bill as the Subsurface Sewage Disposal System Improvement Fund, and it's for financing grants and loans for the capital investment of on-site systems that might be needed. And also provides for some training and technical assistance to provide to homeowners. The bill is currently drafted would allow civil penalties collected from septic system and sewage disposal violations to be deposited in this fund. Just to give you some perspective, over the last 10 years, penalties have typically been about $20,000 per year. So that's what we would estimate would be in this fund per year. And the way it's set up, DEQ could also be allowed to accept grants or contributions to this fund from other sources. There is some information that nationally this is an issue and there could be some efforts to bring funding to this problem. That's speculative at this point, but if that were to happen, we'd want to have this fund available to serve that purpose. So again, the fund would serve two important needs that DEQ is currently unable to meet. One, it'd help homeowners who need help financing septic system repairs and replacement, which typically can be very expensive. And it would also enable DEQ to provide more training assistance to communities with septic systems. I believe this bill would help Oregonians who face financial hardship when they learn that they need repair for their septic system and would improve the likelihood that environmental and public health risks resulting from failing septic systems would be addressed in a timely manner. So with that concludes my testimony. I've provided written testimony for you to see, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Or
if there's any questions, I think my vice chair may have a few, but let's look over here first. Senator Thompson.
Yeah. Thanks for looking this way first. I know you get that kink in your neck.
I knew he had a question, but I will let him ask it after you do.
Thank you. Just a couple of questions. I know there's kind of a perception or attitude that people have problems with setting up a loan fund or something that you guys, the DEQ, would find somebody for and feed that fund. You do that process now in a way if somebody has a problem. There are fines to septic systems out there?
Yes.
And where does that money go now?
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, the way it's currently structured is if there is an enforcement action that results in a fine, that fine would go to general fund.
And so there's follow no up? Way you can no, follow up, please?
Go ahead, Senator.
So there's no way you've been, instead of making a bill to do that, that you could set up your own program to get that money through the general fund to do that?
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, certainly a bill could be set up to say we would get general fund specifically for this. That's not the route that was recommended by the advisory committee. So the recommendation was to look at the penalty diversion.
One more.
Sure.
I noticed, to me, the idea is good. I know personally in Hood River County we've had some problems with septic, and we've dealt with developing a whole septic system due to failures and due to the soil and the hard pan issues in those areas. We got the problem solving. There were people that just installing a new septic tank for $3,000, they didn't even have the money to do this. So I agree that the grant loan program would be good, but I also see that in here also it says you can use that money for training and other, and I would be afraid you'd use more of the money for training and stuff than the grant program. So you're going to choose to run just the grant program, but it says you could use that money for training also. So.
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, I think your point is well taken, and certainly if there's constraints put on through the bill that certain amount or a percentage or all money has to be directed to this purpose, I mean, certainly that's something we'd be willing to talk about. But I understand your concern that you're worried about a potential that we wouldn't make the money available for its real purposes to help individuals and communities with their septic systems. Yep.
Okay. All right. Senator?
Would you please explain the training that you talk about?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I'm going to let my staff here, Randy Trox, talk about that because he deals with that end of the program for sure. So, Randy.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson.
Can you state your name for the record?
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
My first time.
That's okay. We'll try to go easy on you.
Thanks.
Go harder.
Randy Trox with DEQ. What we were hoping to achieve is we have a lot of licensed installers throughout the state, a lot of it in really rural areas that have part of a license requirement is certification, continuing education. And in rural parts of the state, there's not a lot of continuing education available, so we would like to use it for that. Agents, we have a lot of new agents that have come into the program. We don't have a lot of resources to spend time with them. And so those were some of the things that we were hoping to achieve with training.
Follow up.
Explain an agent.
Sorry. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson. An agent, we have 22 contract counties. We don't run the program directly. The county runs the program. And so an agent is could be either DEQ or a county employee.
Okay.
I have another follow-up.
Okay. Go ahead.
Concerning the process, I can appreciate it. It's notable. I'm a little concerned that DEQ now wants to get into the realm of being a banker. Giving out grants and loans, that bothers me a little bit because you have a lot on your plate. You do a lot in this state. And now we're going to open the door to another area. It's important that septic systems work. I'm in the industry. I understand the process. I'm a little concerned on some of the examples. Bless you. I'm a little concerned on some of the examples you've given. where the first one here, that the system failed and it directly affected their drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've been in this business a long time, and I know that to have it fail that badly and affect a well, it's failed for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And most properties need to have an alternative site for their system. So basically what you're saying is if your system fails, then we will help you buy or put in the new system, whether if you can't afford it, to do the work. And what criteria do you use? How will you determine financially that they cannot afford to make a replacement?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Olson, first of all, I want to thank you for acknowledging the workload and all the work that we have to do and your concern for that. Just in terms of providing grants and loans, we do have a pretty large program in DEQ that where we do that. It's called the State Revolving Loan Program, where we loan to communities for wastewater treatment improvement. So we have some experience in that, but I want to thank you for your concern for our workload for sure. So one of the things that we talk about is the EQC establishing rules to implement this this loan or grant program, if you will, and it would be that time where we'd set out the criteria so that we're ensuring that we'll only loan to the people that really need it, and it's not an opportunity for people to avoid their own costs. So that's the kind of thing I think we would set and establish by rule.
Follow up. In this system, then, if a person had a standard subsurface drainage system and they came in and they had, for example, myself, I have a big yard, mm-hmm. and I can do a replacement area. And I read in one of these that they didn't have enough room to do a regular system, so they had to do the ATT system.
Mm-hmm.
Point one is, why didn't they have enough room for their alternative system? And point two, when you force them into this ATT system, which is a very expensive, to say the least, that also needs to have an area for drainage and an alternate area. If they didn't have enough room for the first system, how do they have enough room for the more expensive system?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, some houses, or before we even had rules where there was a requirement for a replacement area, there's some really challenging lots we have, particularly over on the coast, a lot of really small lots, challenging soils, and the best we can do is a treatment system, and sometimes it's, well, you know how expensive it can be to put some of these systems in, so.
Follow up. So you would, what you're saying is that you would overlay the ATT system over a system that's already failed, the drainage areas?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, not necessarily, but we have sometimes, I know there was a site near between Mapleton and Florence where they dug out a seepage trench and put in a new seepage trench. It's sandy soil right along the Siuslaw River, and they put in a treatment system because there was really nowhere else to go on that particular case. And sometimes, you know, we don't get to pick the sites. It's just we have to try to manage a repair as best we can.
And now I'll let you know where I'm going with this.
Mm-hmm.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. It concerns me because as we get into more of an environment of clean waters, I see if someone has a standard system that fails, I see demands put on perhaps by DEQ to go to these more expensive systems. Would there be any safeguards so that they could replace with an ordinary system if appropriate? Or would you demand the better systems?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's a good question. And my, in speaking for our staff, I would tell you that their interest is making sure, not only looking at having a good system, but making sure that a system that's put in that is considers cost. So if a traditional system would work on that site, they wouldn't promote a higher advanced system just because. I think they go out and really look at the condition of the sites and make professional judgment on whether a standard system will work or not. And if it won't, it's based on a number of factors, as I'm sure you know, and try to work with the homeowner on the least cost system that's going to do the job.
One more, please.
Final. Otherwise, I'll have you follow up after the hearing.
Let's be a final.
Yeah.
The final concern is then, since the funding is not adequate, mm-hmm. it's going to run out immediately. As soon as somebody gets wind of that we can do this, it's going to run out. And my concern is if you do move, and I don't know if we should put an amendment in there or not to prevent you from upgrading systems as you require, that this fund is going to far exceed, or I mean the use of this fund is going to far exceed what's there. And I see a tremendous burden put on the general fund to make up what's going to happen here.
Okay, Senator Krasinski.
Dick, just for the record, Senator Olson asked about your experience, I guess, as DEQ, being part of a loan or grant-type program. Mm-hmm. Could you just, for the record, tell us if what other areas DEQ has had similar type of programs that administered a grant or funds?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, I'd mentioned the State Revolving Loan Program, which is a growth out of the very long ago that what's called the Construction Grants Program, which was to loan communities financial resources. It went from a grant program to a loan program. So we manage a $40 or $50 million program of self-sustaining loans that go to communities. We prioritize them and work through that and loan out based on that. We provide grants for diesel retrofit. We get money from the federal government to pass through and provide loans or grants to for school buses and others to upgrade their diesel. We get some grant money for leaking underground storage tank programs where we grant that out. We get grant money for repairing restoration, if you will, through what's called the 319 grant, which is an EPA grant. So we have some experience. So we do have experience with that. I'm not going to suggest that this isn't more work, but it's not different work, I guess I would say.
And the last question, just
sure.
to follow up on that.
Mm-hmm.
This particular program, when we discuss this in a conference, I understand is really a small amount of money that's mm-hmm. actually going to be available. And I think to answer Senator Olson, when that money runs, do we automatically have any mechanisms to tap in other money? Isn't it once that money's gone, then the program's concluded until you get additional authorization for funding?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, that's true. I mean, we've looked at actually the SRF program, whether that might be available. It's only available for public entities, and so that's not there. So to the extent that if this were the funding source, if it's gone, there's not the bill doesn't or there's no desire for us to go to general fund to augment that.
All right, thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Well, we have a lot of people that like to testify.
Just a short one.
Okay.
What do you do if someone does not pay back the grant money? What's the recourse?
Well, a grant is a grant,
right.
So it would be a loan.
So what happens if they're not? You loan me money and I don't repay you. What's your recourse to recollect the money?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I don't have all the detail related to other programs, but we would use whatever legal mechanisms that we have to recover that.
And a quick follow-up, you had mentioned, because I had asked Greg Aldrich if there was any possibility in looking at the SRF program, since you already have that, and mm-hmm. passing the money on to municipalities so they could grant it to their, or it could be counties too. So I don't know if you've looked at that mechanism at all. I mean,
Madam Chair, we can, the SRF State Revolving Loan Program is for public entities,
right.
So we can loan it to public entities. So if there's like a public sewer authority or whatever, we could loan to that, but not to private parties.
You could loan, just the question I had was you could loan it to counties, and the counties could then, you know, if they wanted to do their own septic grant. I mean, most of this is going to be in counties,
mm-hmm.
Probably more than cities. But
yeah.
Just trying to figure out, I mean, the only concern I have about this is that it's not enough money. And
right.
We all know that we do have septic problems. I've been working with, we're going to hear from Central Oregon and the problems they've had there.
Mm-hmm.
I have an area in my district that is not on sewer within the city of Portland, and it's very expensive, you know, for them to upgrade. And so it doesn't always happen because we are, the good news is that we are requiring a more sophisticated and more state-of-the-art systems.
Mm-hmm.
However, they are more expensive. So I think that the intent of this is really good. It's unfortunate that, you know, $20,000, I know it's a start, and there may be some other sources of money down the road. It won't get us very far, but I think it'll be interesting to hear from, we have a whole list of people that would like to testify on this, so I think it'll be interesting to hear the public testimony on this and appreciate the hard work you've done on this so far.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, so Rob Barnes, Alec Malk, did I say that right?
Mock.
Mock, okay, and Jason Hauser. Thank you, gentlemen, and sorry about the name mispronunciation. So why don't you go first?
Chair Dinkelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Barnes. My address is 15415 Oakdale Road, Dallas, Oregon. And I'm the current board member of the Oregon On-Site Wastewater Association, also known as O2WA. I also own King's Septic Pumping Service, and we service septic systems in Marion County, Polk County, and Yamhill County. I'd like to state that as an industry professional and member of the O2WA board, I support Senate Bill 83. And while you've seen the background information that was just presented on the number of percentage of population in Oregon that is served by septic systems and the 10% that have systems that are failing, what I'd like to just take a minute and do is put a face on one of those 115,000 constituents who has a failing system. Yesterday, I went to a home of a lady by name Diane Olson. She lives in rural Polk County. She's one of four jobs that we did. And Mrs. Olson is a 60-plus-year-old lady who's lived in her rented home in the country for over 20 years with her family. She has an elderly landlord who's on an extremely fixed income, and her septic system is over 35 years old. If you ask many of the regulators the lifespan of a septic system, the one in Polk County will tell you approximately 30 years, and that's a function of a couple of items. The materials and the technology was known at the time, and lack of education of the consumers on how to maintain a system. In this case, the system is starting to fail. The last 7 years, we've been out there numerous times trying to keep this system working for this 60-some-year-old lady and her family. When it acted up again over this weekend, she was hesitant to call her landlord because she was afraid that I was going to say that the system's going to need repair and he didn't have the money. So hesitant that before I got there, this lady had put a latex glove on up to her wrist and reached her arm into her armpit, down to her armpit, in a backed up sewer line trying to unplug it, rather than call her landlord and have him call me to service it. Obviously, she couldn't unplug it, so he called, and we were able to get the system working again. But when we were done, I shared with her that the system was getting close to the end of its effective lifespan, was going to need some repair. When I said that, she almost broke down in tears. The reason for that is she knows that her landlord does not have the financial resources to repair that system. And her words to me is, I'm afraid there's only two alternatives. One, evict us so that no one uses the system and it doesn't get worse, or sell the property. She says, then where do I go? She says, I've lived here for 20 years. We've cleaned out acres of blackberries. We've planted gardens to provide our own food. We renovated a pond. There's, you know, wildlife using it. She said, this is our home. She says, where would I go? I didn't have an answer for her. Ironically, she had heard about this bill from someplace. She said, I hear that there's something going to the legislature that would be maybe make loans available for repairing systems. And I told her, I said, that is a proposed bill, Senate Bill 83. I said, I am going to hearing on it tomorrow. If you don't mind, I will share your story, but nothing has been decided on that yet. And she was more than willing to have me do that. Helping people like Diane Olson is what this bill is about, with the potential of not raising taxes. Senator Olson asked a number of very good pointed questions about the amount of money and this type of stuff. Why this won't help everyone, the key word is it's a start. Mm-hmm. It's some place to start with developing monies for this and programs for this. I'm sure the DEQ doesn't have all the answers yet for how it will be administered. There are very competent people. I'm sure that will be put in place if it is passed. personally, I would be willing to help develop the education materials, help present the education seminars to not just the regulators, but to the homeowners so that they can better maintain their systems. And frankly, my company and I would even be willing to help contribute money to the fund to get it started. But it's a very rare opportunity that Senate Bill is one of those rare cases where the state agency has seen a need. They've came up with an action plan that does not require additional funding from state funds. They've engaged affected parties in the plan. The plan provides help to the people of the state, and it continues Oregon's long history of protecting our environment. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I will gladly answer any questions you might have of me.
Great, thank you. Why don't we hear from everybody, and then whoever wants to go next, so we'll take questions.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jason Huser. I'm the legislative liaison for the Eugene Water and Electric Board. Thanks for having us here today. EWEB provides drinking water to 200,000 Eugene area residents. Our sole source of drinking water is the McKenzie River. So you can imagine we definitely strive to be excellent stewards of the McKenzie and to promote general stewardship values in many of the residents and other users of the river. We support Senate Bill 83 and thought it would be helpful to share with you some of our experiences and how this bill parallels steps that we're taking right now as a utility to help McKenzie River property owners make repairs to failing septic systems and mitigate water quality risks. In the summers of 2008 and 2009, EWEB, with grant assistance from our colleagues here at the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, we received grant assistance to implement the McKenzie River Septic Assistance Project. This limited-duration project conducted educational outreach about septic system maintenance and invited McKenzie residents to take advantage of free septic inspections and, if necessary, septic pumpouts. Out of approximately 4,000 homes in the McKenzie River corridor, we had 439 systems that were inspected through the program, 108 were pumped out, and 55 were determined to need repairs and posed a risk to water quality. Now, I would think we would say, and upriver residents would agree, that the project was a success in raising a lot more awareness about the need to maintain septic systems. However, a sobering statistic is that as of today, of the 55 failed systems, only three that we know of have been repaired. And all three that I know of were done through a home equity loan. That's an option that may not be available for many folks. So it's a logical extension of the septic assistance project for EWEB to now try and do something about raising that number of repairs. In January of this year, the EWEB Board of Commissioners voted to move $100,000 of water reserves into a loan program that will offer 0% interest loans to property owners to make the repairs that are necessary to get those failed systems taken care of. It's just one step. Again, for us, it's a beginning. We may do more in the future. And I wanted to share with you the experiences that we've had and what we're doing to take care of the McKenzie. We certainly see the statewide need being there, too, and we urge you folks to see what you can do to get this loan program started.
Thank you. Sir. Mr. Malk.
Mock.
Okay, I'll get
just
it right
like
by
it
the
sounds.
Third time.
Like it looks. No, kidding. Senator Dingfelder and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to present my support for Senate Bill 83. My name is Alex Mock. I'm the owner of Goodman Sanitation in Troutdale, Oregon. It's a family-owned business that was started by my grandfather in 1948. Been to a lot of conferences and stuff. I'm one of the few that was born into the industry. I've seen a lot of things, a lot of changes over the years. I'm a founding director of the Oregon On-Site Wastewater Association, as well as a acknowledged contributor to the EPA manual on on-site sewage. I live and breathe septage. It sounds to me like many of you members would meet the statistics. I was going to ask how many of you do have septic systems. I know Senator Thompson does. It sounds like Senator Olson does. And that would certainly make the 30% that we're seeing here that we're looking at. Yes. And currently, I sat on the rule committee that kind of made this recommendation, and the chair of that committee was Stephanie Halleck. And we knew this was going to be a real tough deal. And we bounced around. We looked at lots of different things to do, and how can we do this? There's a real problem in that currently the whole on-site program is fee-driven. And we all know that we're having a tough time in the economy right now, and there are no permits, so there's basically no fees. Now, I do actively run some of the equipment in my business. I am out there seeing people on a regular basis. And there's no question, I had an incident come up not too long ago. It was a bad inspection, in my opinion, of a county. I mean, they messed up. It was bad. It shouldn't have never happened. It cost the people that moved into the house. They had to put in a whole new system. I reported that to DEQ, and absolutely nothing has happened. And part of this whole problem is, and I'll be honest with you, back in 99, I actually sued the department. So I've gone on both sides of this fence. You know, they've been my enemy and they've been my ally. That's just kind of the way things happen. But currently, the enforcement, there's little to none. And I look at it as an industry guy who's been in the business forever, that either we just abolish the whole thing, run the crap into the nearest creek, and call it a day and everybody will be happy, or we've got to come up with some real solutions. Because I, last week, watched two illegal installations of septic tanks. People don't want to come. They don't want to go. They're afraid of their government. I don't think we ought to be afraid of our government. I think our government should try to help us. I don't know if this is the right answer, but like some of us who have testified today, this is at least a start. I haven't seen anybody else come up with any kind of a better plan. But I know we have a big problem out there, and there are a lot of people, and I run into it every day, that just don't have the funds. I know people who are on sewers. There's always been some kind of programs for assistance or whatever when you got to hook up to the sewer. When I was a kid growing up, it was like septic systems were a temporary fix until the sewer comes. The sewer's not coming. And I think Senator Olson asked about these ATTs and stuff, and that is a concern. And this education thing is going to be real important because we do have a group of regulators that want to jump right into that expensive stuff without really looking at can we do the other. But we have a pretty good watchdog group and some pretty good professionals in the On-Site Wastewater Association. And so that is something we're going to want to look out for. But I think we do need the support for this. We do need to move forward somehow because we've got a big problem out there and it's just getting worse.
Okay. Thank you, sir. I actually am going to ask, this is the chair's prerogative, I get to ask the first question this time, and I'm going to follow up on your testimony for both of you gentlemen who are members, I think you're a member as well, of the Oregon On-Site Wastewater Association.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Senator Dinkelder in the committee. I'm a founding director and also a member.
So a question I had is, do you currently provide any training or technical assistance? When I read your testimony, I guess it was from Scott Davis, your president, it says that your association represents all those serving Oregon's on-site industry. I guess the question I have is, what is there a gap between what you're providing, the type of education and training, versus what DEQ is talking about? Because we had a question about, you know, what DEQ's role would be. I've worked more on the wastewater side, and used to work for a large engineering firm that installed and trained wastewater operators, and I know there's a very, you know, rigorous training for wastewater treatment operators, so I'm not as familiar on the septic side. So maybe you can talk about that aspect a little bit in your perspective on DEQ's role in that training, because it also sounds like your association could be providing that type of training, not necessarily regulation, since you're an association. So either of you would like to comment on
that? Senator Dingfelder and the committee, I'll take a stab at that. I think most of us that are involved in the industry at some level or other, we're all involved in the education business. Currently, I have a website that I've noticed lately that, you know, we pull our customers. How do you get a hold of us? And in the last 5 years, it's been more on the Internet than it has the yellow pages. And so we provide a lot of educational information, pumping frequencies and that kind of stuff. All my staff, all my employees, we have regular meetings where we have trade journals that we look at so that we can offer advice to people. There is a little bit of difference in training. I'm also a licensed real estate broker. So I do a lot of training through title insurance companies. I go to real estate brokerage outfits. Pretty much anybody. I've gone with the Soil Water Conservation of Multnomah County and done free seminars as part of a community service. The DEQ does training, not so much on the side that we do, but they have a very good website, and I think that's probably an area they want to look into more. We don't really have the available training to us or to even go out to the public that we really need to be at right now. People, you know, I see it all the time. They move out from the city. They got no idea. This might not be great for public, but we have interesting conversations in our group, and what we see in septic tanks now versus what I used to see 20 years ago is mind-boggling. We never saw pharmaceutical syringes, baby wipes, all these kind of things are going into the septic system, causing premature failures and these expensive repairs. So we need a big education thing on the public. I hope I answered that a little bit.
Yes, sir, would you like to add to that?
Chairman Dingfelter, members of the committee, Alex is right. Unfortunately, the industry itself is realizing that we need to provide education. The education primarily needs to go to the consumer. If consumers understand how systems work, one, their investment is protected, the environment is protected, and they don't have near the repair costs that they have. At present, it is an individual by business basis. Alex has his website. We have an information packet that tax dollars has paid for, Oregon State University Extension Service, that we provide to every customer that has the recommended pumping frequency. In our case, they're in a database. We send them reminder cards when it's time to pump again. We've seen the number, by educating customers, we've seen the number of emergency calls go down. There is very hard data that shows that if people understand how they work, systems last longer, you don't have the repair costs, you don't have the need for this revolving fund that we are talking about. That's why education is such a big part of this proposal. Not only for DEQ to educate regulators, but also so that there can be a joint education program that is from the top down, disseminating it to the consumer, the people that are actually paying and using these systems. That's one of the most exciting things for me about this program, is the possibility of a concerted education effort to educate the homeowner how their system works, how to maintain them, how to protect the environment.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Gentlemen.
Anyone? I had a feeling you have a couple.
Anyone can answer. You talk about septic system failures. I'm pretty familiar with this subject, so I'm going to grill you on it. What's the main cause of failure?
Lack of education, sir. I'm sorry, Madam Chairman, Senator Olson, lack of education. Because homeowners don't understand how systems work. They fail to maintain them. They don't understand that they're a maintenance system, just like changing oil in your car. A lot of people, because mom and dad never pumped theirs, they think until the toilets don't flush, don't worry about it. And I tell them you can weigh 600 pounds and eat 5 Big Macs a day and not worry about your cholesterol. You can have a heart attack, too. But when it happens, life changes. Same way on these.
Okay. I'm going to follow up on that. I know you're going to know the answer to this, why they fail. What fails? What fails on the septic system? It's usually the tank.
Riddex.
This might be a trick question, so watch out.
The tank fails.
The tank fails.
And runs sludge out into the drain field.
Basically, Madam Chairman and committee, what will happen is that a septic tank is nothing more than a giant filter. That's really what it is. And when we see these TV commercials, you know, dump the little powder and it'll take care of everything and it'll do this and that, I've been to many conferences where there's actually been studies. And, you know, if it was up to me, that stuff would be illegal. I know of no filter, no your heating, your oil in your car or whatever that can be fixed by a magic powder or something with a little bit of color in it. When I was a kid, we had a guy that used green food coloring and Alka-Seltzer. Look out, she's hot. Charge you, what, $35, and there's your chemical. But it's like you said, it's lack of education. People just don't know. Again, septic systems were a temporary fix until the sewer came. When I was a kid in school, it was like, well, what are you going to do? You guys are going to be out of business. Our business is growing. Senator Olson, you asked on some of these sites on these ATTs. I did an evaluation for a real estate transaction last weekend and killed the deal. There was not room to put in another system. Now, Randy tried to answer, but, you know, Randy does a real good job what he does on the regulation side. I don't think he's put in the hundreds of systems that my company has. I might mention that we're kind of worldwide. With the advent of the Internet, I'll have a guy going back to the Virgin Islands, and I sold a truck to American Samoa last year. So it's interesting what we get to go do. But some of the new technologies and some things that we don't even have approved in Oregon, we can make you drinking water if you're willing to drink it. We've got ultraviolet lights. You can chlorinate. So a lot of these sites that we're having to deal with now that have old failing systems don't really have any room for. So now we do, they used to call them non-conforming, but you don't want to do that. But we do the best possible repair that we can do.
Okay. The point, and you're absolutely correct, it's education. Because I build a lot of new houses, and most of the time my septic installers don't sit down with the homeowners and say, hey, folks, you should pump this tank every 3 years. You might. A lot don't.
I would like to respond to that.
Hang on.
But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And so education is critical because people that are on septic systems don't know what they're putting into them. But on the other side of the coin, you have to remember that if you're on a sewer system, those folks are responsible from the curb to the house. So we're opening up a door here that is somebody's going to be coming in that door saying, wait a minute, if you're going to help those folks with failing septic systems, if my line fails from the curb to the house and I'm on a sewage system, on a city system, I would like to get some help too. I'm just going to, the point being is that this is going to be massive when it starts. We have, 115,000 septic tanks that potentially have failed. We have $20,000 a year. Do the math. The money's not there, and it's going to have. When we open this door, people are going to start looking for that money, and we're going to have to figure out a way to come up with it. And it's going to come from one person or one group of people and one group of people only, Oregonians.
I think that was more of a comment than a question.
That was
so
a comment.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
It was a comment.
And maybe you can help us find some other sources of funding. Sounds like you have a lot of experience. So thank you for testifying today.
Thank you.
Last but not least, we have Tony DeBone, Deschutes County Commissioner. Thank you for being here. And Tom Anderson. Did I say that right?
DeBone, yep.
I haven't been doing too well today with the names. So.
No problem.
Welcome. Thank you for coming over. I hope the pass was okay on your way over.
Not too bad. So, yeah, Madam Chair and the committee members, thanks for having us today. I'm a newly seated Deschutes County Commissioner, and we do have a map here. We don't need to use it too much as reference, but it does show that we do have many, many septic systems in our South County area, South Deschutes County. These are rural plotted lots that have just this classic situation. I'm just listening to the testimony today, what's kind of going on at the state level. We've got quite an on-site program that the county manages. And right now we have a citizens committee, DEQ steering committee that's been coordinated. So we've got a situation where we're trying to figure out what a good solution is for a large area. And we do have some failing systems, some requirement for ATT nitrate reducing systems right now. And we're trying to figure out what it looks like in the long run for some of our South County areas. Rivers is the major driver here. We want to make sure that we don't have too much nitrate loading in the rivers. A little story about where I'm coming from. We're about four generations in the area now. So my wife's grandparents moved to the area, and they moved there on a fixed income originally. So, they retired from the Navy, checking out of society a little bit, living in the high desert in Lapine area. So as systems fail, as requirements change, we do have problems and needs for this kind of money. Right now, we know we can reduce nitrates in the future. What about pharmaceuticals and some of the complications that could happen? So we want to take an aggressive stance at trying to make sure, as I say, save the rivers down there. But we do have people, fixed income, the world's evolving, things are getting more and more expensive. So there's some good value in how these funds could be used. I think some of the research and money could be used for alternative solutions, trying to figure out what else can we be doing. We've got sand filter requirements from the last few years. Now we've got ATT brand name nitrate reducing systems, and basically that's about an $8,000 add-on to a complete system. So we're looking at $10,000 to $25,000 sometimes when you need to either put in a new system or rebuild an old system. So things can add up pretty big. Also, some of the community support funds may be available that we could be putting sewer systems in the future. So we'd like to maybe use these funds for that kind of work and research our sewers appropriate for some of these areas.
All right, thank you.
Yep.
Would you like to add anything?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Anderson. I'm the Community Development Director in Deschutes County. Similar to Randy, no, I'm just here to answer questions and help out if I can.
Well, I appreciate you coming here today. We had a committee hearing when I was in the House, I think, 5 or 6 years ago on this exact issue in Deschutes County, actually at the in your county building. And it was quite an interesting discussion. We had folks from both sides of the issue, but obviously it's an issue that's not going away. So certainly hope that we can work with you to try to solve this problem. See if there's any questions from either of our, any of our committee members.
Yes, ma'am.
You have a question?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Mr. DeBone?
Yes.
If you find a system that fails in your county, what's your process to deal with that system?
I'm going to defer to Tom on that. He's been doing this for a long time.
Okay.
Well, we have a code enforcement program in my department, and we are very active in working with people to get that system repaired. Generally, all code enforcement complaints come to us through a complaint-driven system. However, if one of our staff people is in the field and notices a failing system, and they're much easier to see, as you know, in the wintertime, then we begin a case through our code enforcement section. It's as easy, I would say, a system as there is out there in local government. We work with people. We give them time. Obviously, a failing system has some health and safety issues. So we work with local nonprofits. If financing is an issue, Neighbor Impact is a very active home rehab program in Deschutes County. So we try and match up property owners to available funding if that need exists. But for a failing system, which is about at the top of the priority for a code enforcement program, we do require that it be fixed and as soon as possible.
Follow up?
Do
you make them change the type of system they use, or are they able to use the same subsurface system?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, we it would depend on the area. In Southern Deschutes County, where Commissioner DeBone is from, right now we have very extensive and well-studied groundwater issues. So in that situation, currently we have an ordinance that requires a failing system to be replaced with a nitrogen-reducing system, an ATT system, which does obviously add a lot of cost to the repair. But again, we do have some financing mechanisms available to us. And if I might, that's where Senate Bill 83, in my opinion, could be particularly effective in our area by matching the limited resources that exist now with the obviously limited resources currently that SB 83 could possibly provide.
One follow-up.
Follow-up.
To replace the systems in your direct control, could you put a dollar amount on that, the systems that would need repair in, say, the next year or 2 years? Do you know approximately what that would cost?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, again, it depends a little bit on the area. If it's in Southern Deschutes County that requires an upgrade to a nitrogen-reducing system, the total repair, including the nitrogen-reducing component, could be in the neighborhood of $10,000,
$11,000. Pardon me. The number of houses that you have that you think need repair times the cost to return would be
the total cost.
The total cost.
Your total unmet need.
Yes.
I guess.
Well,
you have a special situation.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we do. I would probably differentiate between Southern Deschutes County and the rest of Deschutes County for the cost of the repair. In Southern Deschutes County, we have approximately 6,500 systems in the ground. So just using the rule of thumb that was used earlier here, that would mean somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 500-600 systems that may be in need of repair. And then using the doing the math with the cost, that could be $500,000-$600,000. That could be required to pay for those repairs. Obviously, the majority of them may be done by the homeowner themselves, but that still leaves quite a gap.
And my point being, then, is the fact that the system generates, our civil penalties generate $20,000 a year. And that's what I'm trying to get to, is this is going to be extremely expensive.
Okay. Senator Thompson.
Yeah. When you have a failed system out there, do you work with the homeowners, or do you find them, and then do you find them first, then work with them to build a new? What's the process?
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, we do not find them. Fines are only used in rare cases where we are unable to gain compliance with whatever the code violation happens to be. In a situation with a failed septic system, the very first thing we would do is meet with the property owner on site to verify the nature and extent of the failure. We will provide them a list of local installers to work with to obtain their own cost estimate of what it would cost to fix their system. And as I said earlier, if necessary, we can match them up with local nonprofits to help close that financial gap.
Thank you. My kind of point is, if we're going to create this fund and we're going to fund it through fines, that we might be looking to increase. You know, the county doesn't fine the homeowner; they're trying to work with them. I would think that in order to build this fund up, they're going to start. DEQ might start finding people that you're trying to help and putting assistance on. It's just a thing that to me might happen to this program.
Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, my understanding these would be not residential fines, more of just DEQ issues, maybe commercial operations. So, and you know, I'd like to hear about that myself, in fact. But my understanding is it's not looking for homeowners to fine. It is just kind of a general policy. Hopefully they have a few years of records where they can show where these fines usually come from, what kind of industries maybe, you know, get dinged for fines in the future that they're looking for these funds to come from.
Well, I'm going to ask the agency to come up. They can have the last word and fill us in on the fines and what the...
I got a question before we...
Okay. These gentlemen?
Yeah.
Okay. And then we'll have whoever from DEQ wants to come up and talk about the fines, right. And then we'll wrap it up. Yep.
To understand from what DEQ, Randy's testified, is that we have agents, different counties that actually administer the program. Is Deschutes County one of the agents for DEQ?
Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, yes, we are.
All right, and I assume in your capacity as the agent, you're the one that's going to define and decide on how you're going to proceed and whether you need to go to a fine structure based on them failing to comply with you, not with DEQ?
Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, the fines that Deschutes County may pursue are different from the fines that are regarded under Senate Bill 83. We do not fine directly. If we have a code violation, we will ask our sheriff's office to issue a citation to circuit court, and then the fine would be paid into circuit court, not part of this program.
One last question. Mm-hmm. But that's in, let's say, follow-up to sanction for a code violation of Deschutes County.
I'm sorry?
That's in violation of an ordinance from the Deschutes County.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate you coming over here, and certainly appreciate your input. And as you can see, we still have some questions, but we'll certainly keep in touch with our committee staff as the bill moves forward.
Very good.
Thank you. Dick, did you want to come back up and just try to address those questions, and then we'll wrap it up? And I'm looking up right now ORS 468-141-140, which is the provision under which the violations are currently in the bill. So if you can talk a little bit more about the provision and how, obviously some of us aren't familiar with how the
sure.
fines are levied and who they would be levied on.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dick Peterson, for the record, Director of Oregon DEQ. First of all, I'll say what we will do for the committee is get a listing of our background in terms of where the penalties have come from. A lot of penalties that we get come from licensing issues and licensing installers that are not licensed and things like that. So we collect penalties from that. And I think on a rare occasion, as the county pointed out, when we have a compliance issue in a county that we're responsible for, we might levy a penalty against a homeowner. One thing I want to say is that I know this is a concern of a lot of people, but it certainly is not our intent to be more enforcement-minded to direct revenues for this purpose. I think we, in practice and in structure, make sure that we're not enforcing to fund, if you will. So, and I know that's a concern, and I respect that that concern, but I just say that. But we can get some more detail to the committee on sort of the nature of the penalties, maybe some examples. But as I said, I understand it's primarily from licensing issues that are of concern.
Yeah, I think that the question is not so much about the intent of the program, but how it would be funded and mm-hmm. where those funds would come from and if it would be adequate enough given the demand. So I think there's obviously some good issues have been raised here. If you can get that information to Beth,
absolutely.
Then we can distribute it to the committee members. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Director, we'll let you go. We've got three other bills to hear. Would anybody else like to testify on Senate Bill 83 before we close the public hearing? Going once, going twice. Public hearing on Senate Bill 83 is closed after that very interesting an in-depth septic discussion. Next up, we are going to change gears a little bit and hear about a bill having to do with the Board of Forestry, which is Senate Bill 345. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 345, and Beth, if you could provide us with a summary.
Senate Bill 345 would require at least one member of the State Board of Forestry to be a representative of organized labor. The bill would take effect upon the next board vacancy. There is no subsequent referral, no revenue impact. We don't have a fiscal impact statement.
Okay, and I don't have the cover for this. Okay, so we have about a half dozen people that would like to testify. Can we have Alana up from the Oregon AFL-CIO? I'm just going to call folks up. I know Roger Beyer wanted to testify, but he had to leave, so he submitted written testimony. And Bob Van Dyke and Bill Cluding, why don't you all come up? Okay. Hey, Alana, why don't you go ahead, and the other gentleman will join you.
Great. Senator, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Ilana Guinea. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. Thank you so much for having me here today. As you've heard, Senate Bill 345 would add a labor representative to the Board of Forestry. And I want to start by pointing out that what this actually does is codify a common practice. We have had a labor representative on the Board of Forestry for most of the last few decades. It's worked very well. I'll get into some of the details of that soon. And we just want to make sure that we're codifying that practice so that we continue to be able to have that representative on the board. You are receiving right now three pieces of written testimony from industry or workers in industries, leaders in unions and industries that are affected by the Board of Forestry who wanted to get their opinions on the record but weren't able for various reasons to be here today. So,
and we have that testimony.
Okay,
yep.
Great.
Thank you.
The first thing I want to touch on is how important this voice is to the board. This is a voice that otherwise wouldn't be represented. Often the conversations on the Board of Forestry vacillate between two groups who have opposing points of view, who have huge interests in the board, and what having a labor representative on the board has done in the past is add another voice to that conversation who can bring to light the effect on the workers in our forests of various policies that are being debated, who can bring to light the effects on the communities around our forests, and who can provide insight into how these policies might affect workers across Oregon that otherwise wouldn't be present on the board. We think that's been incredibly important. A labor rep brings a new perspective to debates. A recent example, and I had a conversation last week with the person who currently serves as a labor representative on the board. The board has been debating the use of pesticides in our forests. And the debate was going back and forth between people who thought that we needed to make sure we could harvest as much as possible from our forests and needed to use pesticides to be able to do so, and those who thought that we needed to keep pesticides out of our forests because it was bad for the health of the other plants in the forest and things like that. And finally, he got up and said, you know, have we considered for a minute what the effects of using these pesticides are on the workers in our forests, on the people who are actually out there on the ground every day? And I bring up this example because working in our forests is often a dangerous job. It is a job that's different from most other employment opportunities in our state. It's a job that is tied to the history of our state, and we need to make sure that the conditions those workers face, the interests that they have, and their needs are being taken into account when we consider policies. You know, what this person said to his fellow board members was, you know, let's make sure if we have to use pesticides that we're doing it in a way that is safe for people who are out there and for the communities surrounding the forests. Let's think about a way we can do this that isn't going to ruin the forest so that we can continue to harvest sustainably into the future. And let's try to strike a balance here. And that balancing voice is what we're trying to maintain with this bill. It's what has been on the board for the last few decades, and it's what we'd like to ensure continues to be on the board well into the future. That's why we think this bill is so important and why many others do as well. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, why don't we just keep going? I know we'll hear some differing views, and then we'll take questions. Bob?
Chair Dingfelder, committee members, thanks for the opportunity to testify. My name is Bob Van Dyke, and I'm the Forest Policy Manager for the Wild Salmon Center. We're a conservation organization based in Portland, Oregon. I'm testifying on Bill 345 regarding the labor seat on the Board of Forestry. The Wild Salmon Center has a long history in the Board of Forestry because forest management can affect salmon, and the Board of Forestry makes policy for state and private forest land. We would not support this bill. While we support a labor voice on the Board of Forestry as part of an overall mix to reflect diverse interests, we wouldn't support this bill as written because it enfranchises only one specific group on the bill, on the board. Forest management affects many interests in addition to labor, including small and large timber owners, conservation advocates, hunters and fishers, hikers and bikers, municipal and domestic water users, ranchers, local governments, and more. Requiring representation of only a single group, in this case labor, does not seem fair. While timber interests are currently limited to 3 seats on the board, even timber is not guaranteed a seat by law currently. To lend some historical perspective to the question before you, I'll provide to the committee a document prepared by the Department of Forestry that shows the membership of the Board of Forestry over time and how it has changed. For example, the board, which started in 1911, originally had 7 members that included the Grange, the Wool Growers Association, and the U.S. Forest Service.
And I'm sure they were all men, probably.
They probably were. It's easy to see. And it's actually got the names here. The governor was actually the chair of the board for many years. From conversations like this one, I think the Western Pine Association was added in 1936, as well as the Oregon Cattlemen and Horse Raisers Association, increasing the board to 9 members. Counties got a seat in 1957, 3 more timber seats in 1958, and then, interestingly, a labor-environmental combined seat in 1959. 2 public members in 75, and then in 1979, labor and environment got separate seats, and the board peaked at 18 members. The current board was born in 88 when they went down to 7 members, and the limit of 3 members that get forest industry income, and regional representation is also required now. So in closing, I'll say the World Wild Salmon Center encourages a thoughtful conversation about the composition of the Board of Forestry and would be pleased to participate in it. If a labor seat is redesignated on the board, other seats should be considered as well. Such an addition of seats would balance the historic and current influence of timber interests while complementing the perspectives of labor representation. I would just like to say in closing, finally, that we supported Mr. Wilson, who's a member of the AFL-CIO and who's on the board now, and I've really profited and learned from working with him. He's been very accessible, et cetera. So I think labor really contributes to the board. But again, our bigger point is that there are a lot of seats you need to start thinking of if you're going to designate a specific seat. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for that historical perspective. I learned something every new in the Oregon legislature, and I learned about the history of the Board of Forestry today. Bill?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Senator Dingfelder, Vice Chair Senator Olson, Senator Thompson, Pozanski. For the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial. I'm here today to voice support for this bill. I think, just for an example, I'll use my good friend Steve Wilson, appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. I think when you confirm these folks and when you look at their background, Steve fit that well. I've known Steve for 30 years. He come from a forestry background. Family worked in the mill. Steve worked in the mill. He knows the value of family wage jobs. But he also knew the importance of sustainable yield in our forests. There is a revenue for our counties, our schools, and revenue for the state. And I think when you make these decisions on confirmation, I would urge you to take a look at finding the labor person that has grown up and spent his life working in force. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Any questions for this panel?
Yes, I have a question.
Senator Olson.
Yes, I always have questions. It says in the law, Senate Bill 345, that the Senate there has created a state board of forestry consisting of seven members appointed by the governor. Further, it states that these appointments shall be at least one member from each of the forest regions established under ORS 527-640. Why do you think that labor should have their own codified seat and nobody else does?
You know, for a minute there, I thought you were going to let us off easy. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, we don't want to presume that we would know who should be on the Board of Forestry. What we do know is that a labor representative has added a broad perspective and a new perspective to the board. We know that that has been a benefit, in our opinion, to both the board, the workers in our forests, and the communities where our forests are, our communities both in and surrounding our forests. And we want to make sure that that practice continues. So we're not trying to say that we know best how the entire board should be made up, just that this has been a benefit and we want it to continue.
You have a follow-up?
One follow-up, just one. So what you're telling me is that you then understand that you know better than the governor who would make the appointments as to who he would want on the board. He perhaps might want somebody from the medical industry or from transportation or from farming. And this basically, you're telling the governor that we want to make certain that you pick any seven you want, but we want to make sure one's from labor. And I agree with the gentleman in the middle that I don't know that this is the governor's choice.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, again, I'm not proposing that I or anybody else is smarter than the governor or would know better than the governor, or for that matter, the people who would be most affected by our forest policy, who I think know better than any of us what voices should be present on that board. All we're proposing is that this one seat is so crucially important and has worked so well. Again, I want to go back to what I first said, which is that this is a common past practice, and it has worked, and we're just trying to codify that practice. I understand your concerns, and if the governor wanted to put somebody with a medical background on the board as well, I don't think that we would have any specific reason for opposing that. I would be interested in seeing what their interest in our forest policy was, but that's not at all our intent with this bill.
Coming. I just have concern over a guaranteed seat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Comment noted. Quick response, Bill.
If I may, yeah. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, that's a very good question, but it's an important issue as of the state forest in this state, and if the labor person was designated, I'm very, very sure the governor would thoroughly, thoroughly make sure of this person's background. And then the Senate has confirmation rights, and I'm sure that between the 30 senators, they would find if this person was the right choice or not. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions on this end? All right. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And we have Gil Rydell and Mary Botkin. And anybody else would like to testify on this bill? Okay. There you go. Gil, why don't you start?
Okay, Madam Chair. I'm Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gil Rydell, Council of Forest Trustland Counties. CFTLC represents the 15 counties that transferred the lands that are now state forests, including the Clatsop and Tillamook State Forests. The Board of Forestry sets policy for state forest management, and we would love to see every one of those seats held by labor. Historically, the purpose of state forests is forest production and revenue for schools and local districts. Labor understands this. But since 1987, the board has moved away from a portfolio system, including, as you heard earlier, a seat for county government. If you're going to return to a portfolio system, we'd prefer that you do it in a more comprehensive manner rather than just selecting one at a time as a designated seat. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you. Mary. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
You may want to move to the microphone just a little bit closer. There you go. Not that we have a problem hearing you, but for people who are listening in.
For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And we have a long history of supporting labor appointments to boards and commissions. And we are equally supportive of making this a statutory requirement. We believe that public policy and agency and public and state policies are better served when workers and working families are represented on every level of state, local, and federal government boards and commissions. A labor representative has a different perspective than their management or industry counterparts, and this person understands the critical role of natural resources play in Oregon's economy and the importance of both protecting and utilizing the resources as a responsible and in a responsible and sustainable manner. They understand the importance of preserving the health of our state forests while protecting them from disease, natural disasters, and overharvesting. Oregon forests should be seen as both a potential for future economic growth and a mechanism for rebuilding Oregon's inherent wealth, as well as areas to be preserved for future generations and environmental health. A sustainable and responsible forest policy for Oregon should include some limited harvest, some set-asides for future generations and recreation, and a responsible forest policy can make room for all the needs of all Oregonians. A labor representative provides one voice to the choir for those Oregonians who work in and with Oregon's environment and the economy. We continue to support appointments to these kinds of boards and commissions for specific labor interests, and would encourage the committee to do likewise. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Mm-hmm. Any questions? You going to let them off easy?
No.
Don't egg them on.
I don't egg them on. Ma'am, I just one question. As a labor representative, how would they have the background necessary in forest management to work on this board?
Most folks who work in the industry in the labor market understand the inherent needs of the forest as well as just about everybody else does. They work there. They understand how the forest functions, and most folks who work there have an inherent knowledge of reforestation and sustainable yields and how to manage the forest well.
Follow up. As an example, if a gentleman from the Machinist Union was to be appointed to the board, how would he have the background in forest management?
The Machinist Union represents the folks who work inside the woods and within the industry.
Okay.
They, just so you know, about 10 years ago, maybe a little longer, the International Woodworkers of America, affiliated with the Machinists Union, actually became part of that. And I have a long history with the International Woodworkers. My father-in-law was a charter member. My father was a logger. I am a native Oregonian and was raised with loggers and dairy farmers. So, you know, I would not presume to know about forest management, but I know people who do.
One follow-up. Mm-hmm. Would you say then that since we were able to codify one position that we should go ahead and codify seven?
I actually don't have a problem with that.
Okay.
You know, I think that people who work and derive pleasure, be it recreational or a living from forests, I think that we all have an interest in making sure that our forests are managed properly. And if the environmentalists want a position codified on the Board of Forestry, then they should absolutely suggest an amendment to the bill and support the bill with the amendment.
Any other comments or questions? All right, thank you both mm-hmm. for testifying. And with that, we will close, unless anybody else would like to testify in this bill.
Yes.
Would you like to? Okay. Would you come up and can you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, I can. Clarence Jones, live in Kaiser, Oregon. And Madam Chairman, committee, thank you for your open hearing. I'm opposed to having a position for organized labor. And a position is organized, which is unions. We've seen in the past with Boise Cascade, the union demanded higher wages. The plants told them, we cannot pay the higher wages. If you go on strike, we will close the plant. They went on strike, we lost the plant. Livingston, California, ground cork and seal. They brought the union in. They told the union, we have updated this plant. We have done everything we can to make this plant profitable. You are demanding more money. If you go on strike, this plant will be closed. The plant was closed. Organized labor is unions. Unions are looking for their interest. They're not looking for the state's interest.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this gentleman?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else would like to testify before we close the public hearing on Senate Bill 345? Okay. So with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 345. We are going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 806. Beth?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 806 would prohibit local governments from adopting or enforcing ordinances, rules, or regulations that prohibit, restrict, condition, or penalize the use of xeriscaping on curtilage of commercial or industrial structures. There is no subsequent referral, no revenue impact. We don't have a fiscal impact statement.
And folks, some people may have learned a new word, xeriscaping.
I have several people who, and
for folks listening, xeriscaping means selection of drought-tolerant plants and minimization of evaporation and runoff. We have a couple folks that would like to testify on that. Chris Fick from the League of Oregon Cities and Tom Tibbs. Come on up. I have a feeling we're going to learn a little bit about xeriscaping today. I actually was familiar with it already.
Not me. I had to look it up.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Yes, Tom, who would like to start? Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, other members of the committee. Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. The League represents all of Oregon's 242 cities, and it's the diversity of Oregon's climate that primarily leads us to oppose the bill before you today. Just as an example, the city of Astoria, as many of you may know, is the third wettest city in the country, receiving over 70 inches of rainfall annually. Burns, Oregon, in the other quadrant, the opposite quadrant of the city, is one of the driest, receiving only 10. As you might imagine, The public policy objectives around landscaping in these two jurisdictions may vary significantly. In Astoria, some of the objectives of landscaping might be to reduce stormwater runoff by encouraging the use of plants that absorb more water. In Burns, the objective may be exactly the opposite, to reduce irrigation needs as much as possible. Other cities may encourage the use of native species, particularly to their portion of the state, while other areas still may require developments on hillsides to provide the appropriate landscaping so as to reduce the likelihood of landslides and erosion. The League is concerned about developers using a bill such as this to argue against local legislation, for example, to advocate for the removal of existing trees, or as grounds to refuse to comply with local government requirements to install stormwater planters, infiltration basins, and rain gardens. As you might imagine, city planners and developers may have opposite opinions about what's xeriscaping and what's zeroscaping, as in industrial and commercial buildings not providing any landscaping whatsoever. Cities need to have the discretion to determine who is trying to conserve water and who is trying to minimize their costs. Depending on the prominence of a development, landscaping might be required so as to match the surrounding environment and provide for an inviting place, an inviting surrounding. This bill would potentially allow barren landscapes to conform with xeriscaping standards. Cities need to have the discretion to determine what's appropriate for specific developments, and for those reasons, we oppose Senate Bill 806.
Thank you. Mr. Tibbs?
Yes, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tom Tibbs. I'm a private citizen and a small business owner. Thank you very much, Chairman Dingfelder and members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify in support of Bill 806. This bill gives small business owners like myself the flexibility to use more ecological and cost-effective landscaping alternatives. I think this bill is necessary to support the reduction of water use and pollution and to make it easier for small business owners to develop projects. I have a personal example I'd like to tell you about that demonstrates the need for this bill. The city of Hillsborough currently has an ordinance that requires the planting of fully irrigated lawn. The statute states, quote, yards adjacent to streets and those abutting a residential district shall be continuously maintained in lawn, with lawn and trees and shrubs established and maintained in a manner providing a park-like character to the property, end of quote. I was developing a small industrial project within the city of Hillsborough that under this ordinance required me to plant a strip of irrigated lawn 35 feet wide and 450 feet long. This local ordinance that required the planting of lawn seems inconsistent with the promotion of other policies that advocate the reduction of lawn to decrease water use. With my engineer, we proposed planting native plants with drip irrigation and as an alternative that is more ecological, cost-effective, and will provide a well-maintained, pleasant park-like setting with the additional benefit of providing habitat for small animals, birds, and butterflies. The proposal was rejected as not meeting the requirements under the ordinance. This ordinance is inconsistent with the efforts of the state to promote water conservation. This is stated in the Oregon State Water Resource Department, their Division 400, 690, their 0010, 0060, and 000, which I've included some parts of that kind of give the state that parameter of which they can require certain things. And almost every bill I receive from Clean Water Services during the water season includes information about using less water and applying less fertilizer on lawns, as well as ideas about reducing your lawn size. Tuolumne Valley Water District and Metro also disseminate similar information. According to the EPA, 30 to 60% of urban fresh water is used to water lawns each year. Turf requires 2 to 3 times the water of sustainable mixed landscapes. Now, I'm not anti-grass, but I believe I should have flexibility to landscape in a way that is less water intensive. For my modest project, I will use, that's that 450 feet by 30 feet wide. During this season, I will use 147,000 gallons of water. In addition, I will be using fertilizers to keep that lawn healthy. My small project will contribute massive runoff into the sewer system and finally making its way into the streams. The exhaust portion from the lawnmower for the year is like driving 2,500 miles in a car. That's just the exhaust from the lawnmower. Allowing xeriscaping will save water, time, and money for small business owners. This simply gives developers flexibility and maintains the administrative ability of local jurisdictions to approve the design plan. I believe there should be an opportunity for more than just a lawn to qualify as, quote, park-like setting. Probably some of us aren't really aware of the U.S. Green Building LEEDs point system, where they're trying to make buildings self-sufficient. But in the landscaping requirements there, number three is do not use any conventional turf, technically less than 20%. That 20% is considered for play areas and what have you. You've probably seen water coming off lawns running into the street, off commercial and industrial landscapes as you drive down the street. I think that water consumption and pollution is an issue of statewide concern that will be best served by a statewide solution, because in the end, the local decisions concerning water will affect all the people of Oregon. I'd like to thank you now for this opportunity, and I'll be happy to answer any of your questions.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for either the League or for Mr. Timps? Senator Hess?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question for the cities. I agree with Mr. Tibbs that this makes a lot of sense. I just don't understand why the cities would want to block this, or at least not incorporate this into the mix of design when it comes to these developments.
It's my understanding that even the city of Hillsborough has a low impact standards that they've adopted, including clean water services and Metro. Not being familiar with the exact plot of land, I couldn't guess as to why they want to maintain a park-like setting in this particular area. But city planning objectives are to maintain some continuity in a neighborhood and be able to delineate what is trying to not produce any landscape whatsoever that would be an inviting area, and what is. Those are the lines for objection. I would highly encourage him to contact the city of Hillsborough and preparing for this hearing, they were not aware of his complaint when I talked to the city manager, or I'm sorry, when I talked to the planning director. So not knowing the specifics of where this plot of land is in the city, how it corresponds to adjacent areas, it would be hard for me to identify specifically why Hillsborough would object to that, what he's proposing.
Did you have a question?
Yeah.
And I concur with Senator Haas. I think the cities need to be more flexible in today's era of less is best. And I deal with this industry, and I deal with the cities, and I know the problems that you come up with, and they're extremely inflexible. And I think that they need to get on board and really get behind this so that they can incorporate it into their programs. Now, do you think that you would be able to encourage cities to do this?
I think cities already are doing this, and that's part of our concern. One of the things we're worried about is that certain species that are encouraged to be planting for environmental reasons wouldn't be able to under this bill. For example, like I said, in certain areas you're going to want to encourage, within bioswales, for example, at the city of Portland, plants that absorb a lot of water so they can filter that water and not release it into our streams and rivers. In other areas, you're going to talk about eco-roofs. I think cities are on the leading forefront of requiring these types of developments, and we think that as the way the bill is written, this xeriscaping would actually move us away from that and not give us the discretion to determine what is most environmentally beneficial in these developments.
So are you suggesting that you have an amendment then for this?
We could work to amend the bill. In particular, we're concerned about Section 2, but we're willing to work with any members of the committee that would be interested in.
Yeah, I think you mean subsection. There's only a
subsection
section
2, I'm sorry.
Right.
Subsection 2.
I was like, looking at
this
a different
is a short
bill. Okay. The concern that I have, and I've been working on this issue for many, many years, and used to work in the Tualatin Basin, so I was sort of surprised to hear that there was an ordinance on the books that would prohibit the use of xeriscaping. Mr. Tibbs, is this actually an ordinance? It would be helpful to have that versus a deed restriction on the property, or was it part of the requirement for development plan?
Chairman Dingfelder and committee. Yes, I think I quoted the part.
We don't have it in front of us, but
no.
Do we?
Madam Chair, well, Mr. Tibbs said he actually went to the city and gave a plan, this is what I heard, and they rejected it. It wouldn't be a homeowners association, which I can understand that could have some meaning.
Right, and the property, as a matter of fact, I meant in you know, we're far beyond all this now in some sense of the word, but I'm kind of locked into it because I really am an organic gardener and I really think water is going to become an issue, as we all well know. The piece of property we're talking about is on the edge of the urban growth boundary. And so, therefore, you know, a natural landscaping there would have been kind of in continuity in the transition phase between the urban growth boundaries and the interface of the areas outside of the urban growth boundary.
So I'm just trying to understand, make sure I understand, though, it was a landscaping plan that you had submitted to the city that
yes.
was rejected.
Yes.
And so, because the way I
rejected
read this.
Rejected twice.
It would be an ordinance that would not allow the use of xeriscaping. And, you know, one question I have, because the state does, I mean, you know, you see it in front of you, the state does, and we've been working on promoting low water use plants for a long time, many cities do. Chris, I'm curious if you have any sense of, are there other cities where this has been an issue, or there's been conflicting ordinances or programs that would inhibit the use of xeriscaping?
I'm not, and it was the initial description of the bill that led us not to pay much attention to it. But again, in subsection 2, local government may not adopt or enforce any ordinance, rule, regulation, or prohibit, restrict, condition, or penalize the use of xeriscaping on the curtilage of a commercial or industrial structure. Our primary concern is who is defining xeriscaping. Is this going to be a lack of all regulation to require certain landscaping under the auspices of xeriscaping, as in we have a minimal amount because we're trying to reduce water? Is that going to affect the way in which citizens interact with this surrounding? Is that going to affect the amount of stormwater that runs off these buildings? It's the lack of definition in the preemption therein that gives us pause as to who is going to be determining what is xeriscaping and what is a bark dust patch.
Okay, well, obviously, this bill needs a little bit of work. There's definitely interest, so I will probably have my committee staff follow up with you, Senator.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Chris, I guess what I'm going to ask is kind of what you've heard down the line. I'd like to see amendments that the League wants. Clearly, I know you're an employee of many masters, many multiple cities have different opinions, and I was pretty shocked to hear the testimony from Mr. Tibbs. I'd love to have someone from the City of Hillsborough contact me as to justifying in this particular case why they took such a position. It seems very strong. Inflexible, and it appears that he had a professional that actually had a plan that should have fit or could have fit, but it seems like they said, no, this is what we want, and you got to do it this way, period. And that seems to be, in this day and time, not productive.
Senator Brzezinski, I will definitely have the City of Hillsborough follow up with you.
Thank you.
And I just got a volunteer. My vice chair has volunteered to help work on this issue with you and the committee staff and you, Mr. Tibbs. So,
Madam Chair mm-hmm. and committee, I'd like to interject just one little thing. And we were taken off the record in this whole process, and we were told that certain people wanted to drive down the street and see lawns.
Taken off the record, could you explain that to us?
Well, they just said, you were not, please don't say who said this to you or anything else, but that, you know, that there were certain individuals within the city that wanted to drive down the street and see lawns.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I appreciate we will get to the root of this matter. I know in the city of Portland, since I took out all my grass and xeriscaped, obviously we didn't have that issue, or none of my neighbors complained anyway. They all came out to see what I was doing, and they were very intrigued, but we decided to xeriscape so we didn't have to irrigate our lawn. But I don't think it's prohibited within the city of Portland. Now, this is in my understanding reading this, this is for commercial industrial structures. Obviously, mine is residential property. So, anyway, my vice chair, Senator Olson, has volunteered to work on this issue. So I think you'll be hearing follow-up from him, and the committee staff will be working with you as well. So thank you for bringing this issue to our attention. I have a feeling we'll be back with possibly some other language. So okay. With that, would anybody else like to testify on this bill?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
So with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 806, and we have one public hearing left on SCR 13. Beth?
Madam Chair, committee members, SCR 13 honors the Eugene Water and Electric Board for 100 years of utility service. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
And we have John Brown, Roger Gray, and Jason to come up. And Senator Przanski, since this is in your district, would you like to say a word or two?
Oh, sure. Why not? I want to thank you all for being here, one, and being here as long as you have been through the other hearings. This is actually an opportunity that we have as a state to recognize the Eugene Water and Electric Board for their participation and being a community partner in Eugene and also in Lane County. As you stated, this is going to be honoring their 100 years. And for those who are interested, the Eugene Register Guard had a wonderful historical perspective that was in Sunday's paper. If you're interested, you may want to go get that. It will be online up for 7 days. They rotate after 7 days. And I will have a question. I want to know if you found the Mars 2.
This sounds like an insider baseball type question. But.
Well, we'll do that during Q&A.
I'm having my iPhone.
Well, if I may. I'll just start the presentation.
Die to yourself. Yeah.
Correct. Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is John Brown. I'm the president of the board of the Eugene Water and Electric Board, and with me today is Roger Gray, our general manager, and Jason Huser, our legislative liaison. We'd like to thank you for the opportunity to acknowledge SCR 13. The Eugene Water and Electric Board was founded in 1911. It's Oregon's largest customer-owned utility and provides electricity, water, and steam to more than 86,000 homes, businesses, schools, and other customers in Eugene and a few surrounding areas. As a public utility, EWEB does not operate to earn a profit or to serve an investment needs of stockholders. EWEB is only chartered by the City of Eugene to serve the interests of its citizens who elect the five commissioners that govern EWEB. Our customers are EWEB's owners. For the first 100 years, EWEB has first and foremost been steady and reliant, keeping power and water costs low and reliably high, driving prosperity and health throughout our service territory. But over this last century, EWEB hasn't been afraid to be innovative or be a trendsetter to thrive into the future. EWEB's very origins are a testament to our community's self-determination. When a typhoid outbreak was traced to the private for-profit water company, our outraged citizens sprang into action and voting to buy the system and create a municipal city-owned water utility. EWEB long ago made a decision not to rely solely on the Bonneville Power Administration for all our power needs, and having our own resources have given EWEB the flexibility to manage our power portfolio. EWEB customers have supported bond measures or other initiatives authorizing construction of the Carmen Smith Hydroelectric Project in 1963, the Foot Creek Wind Project 1997, and recently the Harvest Wind Project in 2010. EWEB was an early adopter of energy conservation strategies beginning in 1977 with the creation of an energy conservation department. EWEB has weatherized over 50,000 homes and now spends about 5% of its annual retail electricity revenues on conservation efforts, adding around 2 to 3 average megawatts of conservation resources each year. EWEB has been a pioneer in the development of renewable energy. EWEB began in 1997 with Foot Creek Wind Project and hasn't stopped there, owning or signing long-term contracts for another wind project, a biomass project, and 2 cogen projects will all qualify for Oregon's renewable portfolio standards, the RPS. We've also supported solar in a form of local feed-in tariff for EWEB customers installing solar PV generation. Over 2 megawatts of solar PV power has been installed throughout this EWEB's incentive program since it was established in the year 2000. The citizenry that founded EWEB 100 years ago also aspired to plan for the future well-being of our community. It is through the hard work and vision of those before us that EWEB has contributed in large ways to making our community one of the finest places anywhere to live, work, and play. Now EWEB and the community we serve and those who will come after us will need to make the next century as successful as the last one. There are many challenges, but also many opportunities. We will continue to protect the quality of our only source of drinking water, the Mackenzie River, but we will also secure a second source of water to mitigate risk. We are willing to work with local, state, and federal officials, as well as residents along the Mackenzie, to find acceptable solutions that preserve this vital and wonderful river. As a largely hydro-based utility and drinking water provider, we will prepare to adapt to the impacts of climate change on water quality and river flows. We will continue to invest in renewable power, conservation, and we've accelerated investment in both our water and electric infrastructure to maintain high reliability in these critical services. We have begun plans to modernize our metering and in-grid infrastructure, as well as plan to make substantial investments in these and other technology areas in the coming years. We are building stronger and newer relationships with our neighbors for the benefits of all citizens of the Southern Willamette Valley. For example, EWEB recently agreed to provide water to our neighbor to the west, the city of Veneta. Our 100th anniversary slogan is Water, People, Power. It reflects our legacy, but also defines our mission going forward. The five EWEB commissioners and the 540 employees of EWEB are committed to serving the community we are so privileged to call home. Thank you very much for this wonderful recognition. We will share it at our 100th anniversary celebration this Friday at the Eugene Water Electric Board's headquarters. Right. Thank you very much.
And John, I'm going to take a cue from my colleagues up here. It's not that we don't want to hear from everyone. If you want to put a little bit more on the record, fine, but I think we actually might be able to go to a work session before you walk out that door and actually move the bill. So as someone says, would you like for us to go into a work session? Or would you like to tell us more? Yeah.
And so procedurally, I'm sorry,
okay.
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Brzezinski, you'll need to help me because
I'm... Big work session.
Yes.
Okay.
Let me just answer the question about the Mars 2.
Yeah.
All right, so the Mars 2 is a Renault R10 that was purchased by EWEB. It was one of 45 that was built by a electric fuel propulsion corporation. It's a car that had a 240-watt socket. It basically had a charge that it charged 26-volt lead cobalt batteries and had a range of somewhere between 120 and 140 miles.
Wow.
That was back in the late 60s. And now we can't find the car.
We may have a lead on it. We think it may be in Florida.
Oh!
I was going to say, I hope it's not at the bottom of one of your reservoirs.
On eBay not too long ago,
okay.
And we missed it. So,
yeah.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for being here. Thank you, Senator, for bringing this forward. You know, I can listen to water stuff all day long, but I know my committee doesn't want to. So, with that, unless there are any burning questions, we will close the public hearing on SCR 13, and we will open up a work session on SCR 13. I accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I move SCR 13 to the floor with a. To be adopted as a recommendation, should be to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Yeah.
The adopted recommendation.
Yeah, with due pass recommendation.
Yeah.
Okay. So Senator Brzezinski moves SCR 13 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. And Senator Brzezinski, would you be
I'm
kind
honored
enough
to do that, but I want to make certain
carry the bill.
If Representative or Senator Edwards, I mean, we kind of put this far, but I want to make certain that we cover it. I'll take it.
We are going to assign you, and if there's any dissension, we will deal with it. And with that, we will close the work session on SCR 13, and we'll see you all on Thursday.
Thank you.
I asked if there is any objection.
Oh,
she did.
I did.
Yeah.